Welcome to Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio. Join us as we explore books and culture through engaging conversations with writers, historians, and creatives, offering unique insights into the literary arts and beyond. Hosted by Ken Budd, Jennifer DeSano, and William Miller. Now, here's the show.
Hello, and welcome to the Upstart Crow podcast. I'm your host, William Miller, and my guest today is Matthew Davis, author of a most beguiling book entitled A Biography of a Mountain, which is to say he tells the story of Mount Rushmore. And the story he tells is so much more complicated, so much deeper and more involved than most people would think. Welcome, Matt.
Bill, thanks for having me. It's great to be on.
This year marks the 100th anniversary of this world-famous monument, built to celebrate America's first 150 years and its accomplishments. In a Substack post, you write that part of what you wanted to do in this book was to think about Rushmore, asking such questions as, what is its backstory? Who influenced it? What were its pivotal moments? What has it accomplished? What don't we know about it? I wanted to ask, as a starting point, what did you know going in, and how does the outcome of all your work match your earlier ideas?
That's a good question. I mean, I didn't know a whole lot going in, which is why I wanted to write the book. There was the sort of origin story of this book is on July 3rd, 2020, Donald Trump gave a speech at Mount Rushmore, and the speech was meant to celebrate the Independence Day and the first time fireworks had been at Mount Rushmore in over a decade. But it was also, if you remember at that time, squarely in the Black Lives Matter movement and how we were thinking a little bit about our national histories. And Trump responded to that and gave a kind of narrow speech at Mount Rushmore about American history and the memorials and monuments built to honor that history. And, you know, I didn't see the speech live. I had just recently had my second kid. There's a lot going on. COVID was obviously happening. But when I began to read about it and to also read about the protests that had taken place at Mount Rushmore for his arrival, I began to wonder why Trump gave that speech at Mount Rushmore. And so just began some cursory, you know, explorations as to how Mount Rushmore was built, who built it, why was it in South Dakota, which is, you know, a question that I get a lot. And in the course of learning about that, I just wanted to learn more and more and more, and really began to see Rushmore and its construction as kind of this vehicle to really think about larger issues in American history, in Black Hills history, and these questions about how we memorialize it. And I think, you know, so from that standpoint, you know, how my thinking changed about it. It changed a great deal, and it changed a great deal both in terms of the research that I was able to do historically, both through archives and books, but I think more importantly, through the people that I met in South Dakota. I mean, I am not from South Dakota. I had only been once before I started this, and I'm not Native American. And in talking with and meeting with and speaking with people from that state and that area, I began to get a better, more complicated idea of the memorial itself and why it matters to so many people, both in good ways and bad.
Well, and your book does that. I mean, it points out why it matters to so many people, both good and, you know, but positively and negatively. You also make the point in the book that this monument couldn't get made now. In some ways, it's kind of an anachronism, right? It was undertaken without engineering studies by someone who was not an engineer, who approached it from the perspective of art and built it as an art object. He was all about grandeur and American pride. And even though that's only one part of the story, it seems to me to be an important part. We don't see that when we look at Rushmore, but what was the process of its getting there?
Getting to the Black Hills?
Yes.
Well, this is actually one of my favorite parts of the story, because I think because Rushmore has become so big, there's kind of this preconception that the idea behind Rushmore was either the federal government's or the sculptor, Gunton Borglum, who, as you said, was, you know, kind of a larger-than-life personality who always thought in these grandiose visions. But, you know, the idea behind Mount Rushmore and the reason why it's in the Black Hills really comes from a kind of a state historian named Doan Robinson, who, you know, was in many ways kind of a Renaissance man. He was interested in all kinds of different things. And, you know, from the design of the state flag to the kind of alfalfa that farmers use in South Dakota to these bridges that were being built of the Missouri River at the time. And in the 1920s, South Dakota's economy was really in bad shape. It was kind of cratering. It's in large measure because of the fall of the commodities markets in South Dakota. I mean, World War I had been a big boon for South Dakota. With Europe in turmoil, the commodities that were being grown in South Dakota got a lot of money in Europe and across the country. And when Europe recovered and those prices tanked, it became clear to Doan Robinson, the state historian, that South Dakota really needed to diversify its economy. And the way that he thought this could happen was through tourism. And he decided that it would be a good idea to build a sculpture in the Black Hills that would attract these car tourists that were then driving from the Black Hills to Yellowstone National Park or all over that region. And so it was his idea to build a sculpture in the hills. And initially, what he conceived of was a series of sculptures devoted to characters from the American West. And these included the Lakota leader Red Cloud, for example, George Armstrong Custer, Lewis and Clark, Sacagawea, the guy who helped Lewis and Clark. And, you know, this was a much more anodyne idea than what Gunston Borglum eventually created in the Black Hills. And it's instructive because, you know, while Robinson had this idea, he needed someone to implement it. And the first person he asked turned him down. But when he asked Gunston Borglum to do it, Borglum eagerly agreed to do it and wanted to do it. And when it became his idea, sort of everything else in terms of nuance, in terms of cooperation, in terms of engineering studies or looking at things from a different sort of way, just went completely out the window, and it needed to really strictly adhere to this vision that Gunston Borglum had. And so, you know, in that sense, artists today, whether they're, you know, whatever they're working in, whether it's literature or visual art or filmmaking or what have you, you know, oftentimes have singular visions that are driving things, but very rarely do they not incorporate other ideas, especially with big monumental sculptures like the one that Borglum was pursuing. It was his idea, it was his way or the highway, and he needed other people to do it, but he was very singular in how he went about trying to get this thing built.
Let's pursue that for a few moments, because without having read the book, I don't think many of our listeners will understand the monumental task of building this thing. I mean, there were 400 people working on this. It wasn't like just one guy out there chiseling on the rock with a hammer.
No, there was not. There were all kinds of jobs at Rushmore. I mean, the way that it was delineated was on the mountain and off the mountain. And on the mountain usually involved you being someone, one of the more important jobs was someone called a pointer. And a pointer was responsible for transferring the maquette, the small model that Gunston Borglum made, what he wanted the mountain to look like, transferring that maquette to the larger mountain that it was being constructed on. So that was what a pointer did. Then you literally had, you know, young boys usually in these winch houses on top of the mountain that were pulling men who were on ropes and pulleys, carving and drilling at the mountain. Those kinds of jobs were on the mountain. Off the mountain were people who were repairing drill bits, who were doing the kind of, you know, non-glorified work that was required to sort of get this process going. And so it's interesting because one of the things that I learned in sort of researching this is that there was kind of a difference in terms of who Borglum wanted to work on the mountain and who the people who were involved locally wanted to work on the mountain. Many people who were involved locally, and that included Gunston Borglum's son, Lincoln Borglum, really liked the idea of giving these kinds of jobs during the Great Depression to local South Dakota people who were unemployed or who needed extra income. A lot of these were unemployed miners. Some of them were ranchers that needed extra work. And Borglum preferred bringing in people from the outside, people he had worked with before on previous projects, to work on this project itself. And, you know, Borglum was a terrible boss in many ways. He was very easy to take credit when things went well and very easy to cast blame when things did not go well. He yelled at his workers. Lincoln, his son, oftentimes had to you know, make sure that they were doing okay once Gunson got through yelling at them. And he really was insistent that no one else, the people could work on the monument, people could build the memorial, people could, you know, chisel and do all the things that was required to make it happen, that no one else would have any kind of say or direction in how this was going to be built. And he really bristled when that those attempts were made. And there was a couple of times when they were made to try to rein him in. And that's when he just lost it.
Borglum, though, he was a bit of an artist. As a young man, he studied painting, he studied sculpture, he went to Europe. Pick up his story there, if you would.
Yeah, he was a great artist. I think Borglum is one of the more complicated characters that I've come across in history or in art or in certainly in this story of Mount Rushmore in particular. I mean, he's sort of an American archetype in some ways. He was born, you know, in Idaho, raised in the middle of the United States, not very well formally educated either. And
born to parents of immigrants.
Born to parents of immigrants, born to Mormons, most importantly, for his story. And he eventually found his way to California, where, you know, he met this benefactress who encouraged him to travel to Europe to study more formally. And he did. And he was in Europe off and on for about 10 years. And it was a very formative period in his life. I mean, I think the most important thing that came of his time in Europe is that he kind of went there as a painter and he left there as a sculptor. And the main reason for that change was, were two things, really. The primary reason was the French sculptor, Auguste Rodin, who he admired. He admired his artwork. He admired his personality. He admired the way that he bucked French cultural and artistic traditions. And he saw himself in the mode, in the model that Auguste Rodin had set forth. And the other important person was his younger brother, who was also an artist, who was a sculptor primarily. And Gunson saw his younger brother, Solon Borglum, gain a great deal of acclaim and success for his own work and grew jealous and was like, well, if Solon's doing this kind of sculpting, I mean, maybe I should engage in this kind of sculpting. And he did. And when he came back to the U.S., from Europe, he never really left the country again in any significant form. Of course, he went to Europe for commissions and whatnot, but he was, at that point, an American artist and really an American sculptor in large measure. And he was very good. I mean, his work, especially later on in his career with both Stone Mountain, the Confederate Memorial outside of Atlanta, and then Mount Rushmore, his two biggest projects were these gigantic, you know, monuments carved out of the physical earth, carved out of granite. But there are some smaller sculptures of his that are really sublime, that sort of hint at sort of a more complicated nature of humanity that I think appeals to me more when I look at art, and that sort of reflect his ability as an artist. And you know, not that Rushmore itself was hard to make. You know, it's not easy to create lifelike sculptures that are 60 feet, you know, long and broad and have human emotion coursing through them. And he was able to do that because he was very gifted as an artist.
So let's talk a little bit more about him. I did a little bit of research on him myself. I mean, he actually was commissioned. I mean, people asked him to do sculptures, and he did a lot of public figures. He's got art around the country. There's another piece by him in the Capitol in D.C. Do any of them that in your research spring to mind in specifically?
Well, there are a lot of important Borglum pieces. I think, you know, his muse, if you will, was Abraham Lincoln.
Hence the name of his son.
Hence the name of his son, exactly. And he sculpted Lincoln many times. I think, you know, one of his most famous sculptures is the one you alluded to that's in the Capitol Rotunda in Washington, D.C. It's a bust of Abraham Lincoln that he presented to then-President Theodore Roosevelt, and Roosevelt kept it in the Oval Office, and then it got moved over to the Capitol. And it's a pretty stunning sculpture. And I was so lucky to go to the Borglum Ranch in Hermosa, South Dakota, and meet with Gunson Borglum's grandson, Jim Borglum. And in this amazing room were all these, you know, artifacts and models that Borglum had worked on. And one was this bust of Lincoln. And, you know, this is why he's so complicated to me. I mean, he was someone who was not only very talented, but admired someone in Abraham Lincoln, who many of us as Americans admire for very, you know, clear, distinct and obvious reasons. You know, Gunson Borglum would also very happily create a huge monument to the Confederacy in Atlanta, Georgia, and was, you know, very friendly with the Ku Klux Klan. And you know, I think those, you know, those elements of his personality, those contradictions are what really interested me as a writer. His sculptures are all over the country. I mean, they're in North Carolina, they're in Newark, New Jersey, they're obviously in South Dakota. He was an artist in high demand, in part because he made himself an artist in high demand. He would have been a very big influencer today, if you will.
And Stone Mountain, we should maybe delve into that story just briefly.
In what way? In his relationship to it?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, Stone Mountain is crucial to his work at Mount Rushmore in a lot of different ways. But, you know, I told you about his brother, Solon Borglum, and some people speculate that the wrong Borglum was asked to come to Atlanta to work on Stone Mountain, because Solon Borglum had actually sculpted statues, Confederate war heroes in Atlanta before Gunson was asked to go down there. And so there's some speculation that the wrong Borglum was asked, but that never stopped Gunson Borglum from being able to take advantage of that. So he went down and, you know, began to think and work with the United Daughters of the Confederacy and other people who crucially were very closely tied with the reemergence of the Ku Klux Klan in that area on Stone Mountain specifically. So on Stone Mountain is where the Ku Klux Klan reemerged in the 1910s. And so Borglum's very, from the very beginning, closely tied to the organization and to the people who were involved in that organization. And, you know, because of World War I and because of financing, there were fits and starts in terms of how Stone Mountain and when Stone Mountain began in earnest. But it was around the 1920s that Borglum spent a lot of time in Atlanta carving Stone Mountain. And he learned a ton that really impacted his work on Mount Rushmore. He learned practicalities at Stone Mountain. So, for example, a Belgian engineer was visiting Stone Mountain and saw the way that Borglum and his team were trying to get granite off this mammoth mountain. And he suggested that Gunson use dynamite and small little packets to blow off piece by piece. So he started to do that, and he used that at Mount Rushmore, which was absolutely crucial to getting a lot of the granite off the mountain. He really learned how to work with local organizations. In Stone Mountain's case, this was, you know, the Ku Klux Klan, quite frankly. It was people that were affiliated with the Klan. He learned to work with them, what they needed, what they wanted, while also working with larger national organizations. In both cases, at Stone Mountain and Mount Rushmore, those were federal, like federal government was involved in both the projects. And he also learned a lot about, you know, how to drive himself both outside working, but to sort of move through and get what you want. His severing from Stone Mountain was very traumatic. He was fired from there. And the reasons he was fired were complicated, and they sort of went down to one crucial element, which is almost always the case in these situations, which is money. The Ku Klux Klan was expecting a windfall from the federal government for this coin that they were minting. And they asked him to lessen his vision, just to take, you know, X hundreds of thousands of dollars, tidy up the project, and then leave so that the Ku Klux Klan, the Stone Mountain Association, could get the millions of dollars and just keep it. And he refused to do that, which in some ways is honorable, but in other ways, you know, is problematic. And so he smashed the models of Stone Mountain, and the Stone Mountain Association wanted to arrest him. There was a dramatic police chase through the hills of Georgia, where he eventually got to South Carolina and then to North Carolina. And all during this period, Mount Rushmore was calling. Literally, Don Robinson in South Dakota was calling Gunson Borglum to come do Mount Rushmore. And so when Stone Mountain failed, Gunson Borglum, you know, decided that he needed to make Mount Rushmore what Stone Mountain was never going to be able to be for him. And it really raised the stakes for him. He could not fail. If he failed at Stone Mountain and then failed at Mount Rushmore, his reputation would be, you know, sullied both then and through history. So he learned how to drive through a project, right? Like, without sort of being able to care who was being affected, what was happening on the ground. He just was monomaniacal in getting Mount Rushmore completed. And, you know, obviously, ultimately, it was to a degree. It was never finished in the way that he had initially envisioned. Mount Rushmore is complete today.
Well, he died in 41, somewhat unexpectedly, somewhat quickly. There was some surgery, and outcome wasn't good. What is a cerebral hemorrhage or something, and he died in 1941. And although Lincoln kind of tidied up a bit, there was no major work done after his death, correct?
There was no major work done. I mean, I think that the thing you have to remember is in 1941, when he died, the U.S. was very heavily spending on national defense. It was very clear where the money was going to be needed. And at that point, Rushmore was largely funded by the federal government. And Borglum died in Chicago in early 1941 March because he was on his way to Washington, D.C. to try to drum up more money for Mount Rushmore. And while he was in the hospital in Chicago, FDR basically sent him a telegram saying, sorry, there's no more money. I mean, we have to sort of devote all of our, you know, spending to national defense. And so when Gunson died, Lincoln finished up with whatever money was left over to finish in any way he could. And what always, you know, sort of strikes me is that construction officially stopped on October 31st, 1941. And literally 5 weeks later, you have Pearl Harbor. And so there is really this confluence of this memorial, this monument that really came, especially during the Cold War, to mean a certain thing, a certain idea of freedom and liberty in the United States that stopped just before the U.S.'s entrance into World War II.
Briefly, there are four men up there. There was brief discussion about a woman.
Well, there was brief discussion about a woman from some quarters. Yeah. I mean, I think there was a lot of interest in putting Susan B. Anthony up there. And, you know, it's really interesting. I forget what year it is, but I think it might be 1935 or 1936. But that's when this push to get Susan B. Anthony on the mountain was really at its most intense. And Borglum's papers, which are here at the Library of Congress, they're full of letters from women across the country, you know, advocating on her behalf. And Eleanor Roosevelt was a huge advocate as well. And you know, Borglum, he was very smart politically. And so he took all these meetings, listened, you know, was in telling Eleanor Roosevelt, you know, this is we're thinking about putting Susan B. Anthony here on this part of the mountain. But he knew there was never going to be anyone else on there, both for structural reasons, which we can get into later, but also ideological reasons. I mean, Borglum had a set idea of who he wanted on there and why. And he was never going to include anyone else.
So let's go into that then. The four guys. Why those four?
Well,
I mean, Lincoln we get, right?
Well, no, it's a little bit more complicated than that because, you know, initially what Gunson and Borglum wanted to do, and this is in part why the memorial is so controversial today, is he wanted to build a memorial to empire. He wanted to celebrate American empire, Manifest Destiny. And he took four individuals who he thought exemplified that in some way. And that was the initial idea for these four individuals. And as time sort of passed, each person on the mountain came to represent a different idea for the United States. I mean, so George Washington, for example, came to represent its birth. Thomas Jefferson, with the expansion of the United States through the Louisiana Purchase during his presidency. And, you know, Lincoln came to represent sort of its saving, sort of the way that it was able to be preserved during the Civil War. And then Theodore Roosevelt, you know, began, he's oftentimes the most interesting person on the mountain, and that many might not think that he would be on there, but because he opened up the Panama Canal, Gunson Borglum sort of wanted him on there as an idea for unifying these different Americas and sort of allowing the U.S. to grow in that way. And, you know, that's how these four men came to be seen to be on Mount Rushmore. But I think the initial idea, and you can see this through Borglum's writings in this time period in 1925 when he was developing his ideas, was really to pay homage to four empire makers and to the empire that the United States had become and was becoming.
In your research, how much do you think he was driven by American mythology to embrace those four? And how much was he driven by fundraising potential or some combination of those? You see what I mean by that question?
Yeah, he was very earnest and genuine in his, you know, desire to create a sculpture and a memorial devoted to these four men and devoted to American democracy. I mean, there is no doubt in my mind that he truly believed that the American political system was the apotheosis of Western civilization. That was what he believed. He explicitly said it in his writings, and it's why he wanted to build this memorial to the United States. You know, I think that Borglum always overestimated his ability to fundraise. From the very inception of Mount Rushmore, he would be, you know, writing people back in South Dakota saying, you know, this will be no problem. Don't worry about it. You know, we'll have all these Eastern money kings who will be giving us money for this project. I'm not concerned about being able to fundraise for this. And it wasn't tied, you know, necessarily to individual presidents on the mountain. It was tied more to the idea. And that money didn't really arrive. I mean, some did, but not enough, in part because Borglum somewhat failed as a fundraiser, but also because they quickly pivoted to the federal government. The federal government did indeed, you know, rescue Mount Rushmore in many ways and provided the vast majority of the money for its construction. But I always like to say that how Rushmore came to be called Rushmore is kind of a fascinating story involving this New York City lawyer named Charles Rushmore. The mountain was named Rushmore by the time Gunston Borglum began working on it. But Charles Rushmore donated $5,000 to the cause. And I like to say that that is the cheapest naming rights purchased in American history.
So you just gave $5,000 for the project itself?
Yeah. I mean, at that time, it was already starting. And he was asked by Doan Robinson, not even Gunston Borglum, to give money to the project. And Charles Rushmore threw in $5,000.
That piece of land before it became Mount Rushmore was part of the Black Hills.
Still is part of the Black Hills.
Still is. But we don't think of it that way. We think of Mount Rushmore, I think a lot of us do, kind of in isolation. Put it in that context, if you would, the Black Hills. And because your book does a brilliant job of contextualizing where Rushmore is and the history of the land.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's absolutely crucial to the story of Rushmore. The Black Hills of South Dakota, which I have come to spend a lot of time in and really truly do love, is a very distinctive piece of land in this larger prairie and plains of this middle American West. And the whole of what is now Western South Dakota was given to the Lakota Nation in 1868 in the Treaty of Fort Laramie by the United States. There was a treaty signed that year because the Lakota were defeating the United States is maybe a little strong, but they had certainly fought the U.S. military to a standstill in different skirmishes out west, and the U.S. just was done with war. So they signed a treaty with the Lakota. The Lakota had, you know, land from the Missouri River up through the Black Hills into different parts of Montana and Wyoming, and that's how, you know, that's how the land was for about a decade. And the treaty said that no Americans could enter that land. It was illegal for Americans to enter that land. The president at the time was Ulysses S. Grant, and he really attempted to enforce those rules. And things changed just 5 years after the treaty was signed. There was a panic in 1873 that was kind of the initial Great Depression in the United States. Much like the Great Depression in the 1920s, banks closed down, businesses were bankrupt, people were suffering, and the U.S. government and the U.S. populace wanted an economic spark. And so in comes George Armstrong Custer in 1874 on an expedition through the Black Hills. That was controversial at the time because I remember no Americans could go in there, but there was one sort of caveat in the treaty, which was for official purposes, Americans could go in there. And so this was given the premature of a military expedition that was going to be finding a fort for the U.S. military. Of course, the main goal was to try to find gold in the Black Hills, and they did. They found gold, which unsurprisingly set off a huge gold rush that initially Ulysses S. Grant tried to prevent, but then just gave up and allowed miners and people to come into the Black Hills in contradiction to the Treaty of Fort Laramie. So at this point, you know, the trajectories are kind of been set. But it wasn't until the summer of 1876 when there was a push to get Native Americans, especially those belonging to the Lakota Nation, onto reservations in South Dakota, that the U.S. military decided they were going to forcibly get the Lakota onto these reservations. And so they engaged in warfare across that part of the plains, which at that point were not part of the country. And everyone knows the story of the Battle of Little Bighorn. Eventually, Custer and the 7th Cavalry met with, you know, over 1,000 different Native Americans, mostly belonging to the Lakota and the Northern Cheyenne. And they completely wiped out Custer at the Battle of Little Bighorn. It was a real victory for the Lakota, and it was an enraging victory for the Americans, who got word of this right around the time they were beginning to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. And Americans were outraged, and Congress was outraged. And it was called for, you know, the seizure of the Black Hills, which ended up happening. And so the Black Hills officially became territory of the United States in 1877, early 1877, and in clear abrogation of the 1868 Treaty of Fort Laramie. And so when you think about, you know, where Mount Rushmore is built, that is the historical context that many people in the Black Hills ascribe to it, and which many Americans don't really know that well. And it's not even just that is so problematic in terms of where this is located. After the Battle of Little Bighorn, you know, to go through the different sets of traumas and tragedies that were put on the Lakota Nation by the United States would take a whole different podcast. I mean, from the massacre at Wounded Knee to the forced takeaway of land from the Lakota and putting them on reservations that are not arable, not really good for farming, to the taking of Lakota children and putting them in boarding schools that was happening just across the country, not just in South Dakota. There is a real series of traumas and tragedies that occurred in that region. And so, you know, when people see this huge sculpture in the Black Hills of these four presidents, all of whom individually and collectively had troubled relationships with Native Americans throughout their political careers. Many in the Black Hills, whether they're native, like, you know, from the Lakota Nation or other tribes, or non-native, see this as well. Many see those four men and the sculpture meant to memorialize and honor them as kind of a slap in the face to many of the other Native communities that were killed and displaced in the American drive west.
Because the Black Hills isn't just where the Lakota Nation lived. It is to them everything that we think of when we think of America. I mean, it's probably more vital to them in terms of who they are and their identity than many of us think of the shores of America as America.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, the Lakota call the Black Hills the heart of everything that is. It's where they cosmologically originate from. It is where so many of their sacred spiritual markers are located. It is defacing a sacred site of another people with the images of people who helped get them to where they are today. And so it's extremely problematic for many people in the Black Hills.
There's a group that would like to have the site of Mount Rushmore, the Black Hills, given back to the Lakotas. What would they do with Rushmore if they got it back? Do you have any insight?
You know, that's a great question. And I do have insights, but I can't say them because I had a conversation with the leader of Indian Collective, who's one of the organizations driving this movement of land back, which is very important. And we were just talking last week when I was back in South Dakota, and he had some really interesting ideas about what he would do with Mount Rushmore. And I can't really share those because those are mostly off the record. But I think, you know, I'll just say this without going into detail, the stereotype of, you know, Native Americans blowing up Rushmore or sort of, you know, spray painting it or defacing it, that's not what I heard. And so I think that there are interesting ways to think about, you know, how this would look. Listen, legally, the Supreme Court has decided that the United States violated the Treaty of Fort Laramie and that land is a Lakota. And they politically, to give a back to the Lakota, I think would be really, really problematic. Financially, the money that was awarded the Lakota in 1980 when the Supreme Court decided on this case has grown in interest to, I think, by some estimates, over $1 billion. So if the Lakota wanted to take that money, they could. If they don't, they want the land back. I don't really have any solutions in terms of how this is going to work itself out, but it's really complicated.
And it is complicated. I mean, in your book, you go into some details about what happened when Trump was there in 2020 and that there was a kind of a counter demonstration organized by the land back movement that was there. And there was a bit of a confrontation between the Lakota demonstrators and the local legal authorities.
Yeah, there were. And even beyond legal authorities, I think that it's the last chapter in the book, and it's called Echoes of History, in large measure because beyond even law enforcement, what you saw were military coming out of the hills, coming out of the trees to sort of surround these nonviolent Lakota protesters. And not just Lakota, there were other people that were there as well. And to hear people who were there talk about that, and to understand the history of what happened at places like Little Bighorn, at Wounded Knee, at other, really traumatic battles across the American West, when literally American soldiers came out of nowhere and slaughtered Native Americans. That is what people were really deeply feeling on July 3rd, 2020, when they were protesting President Trump's arrival. And it oftentimes, when people would tell me these stories, they gave me chills, because it's just like, this is one of the reasons why the Black Hills have really resonated with me in many ways, because it's one of the few places I've been where, history is not confined to the textbooks. It's sort of a living, breathing organism that you really can't escape.
In your book, you also go into the Rapid City Indian School as a kind of a microcosm of some of those mistakes that were made. Talk for a few moments, if you will, about Rapid City and the school that was there, and the efforts to memorialize the children.
Yeah, this was really interesting to learn a lot more about. So the Rapid City Indian Boarding School was in existence from 1898 to 1931, I want to say, or 33, I think it was. And many children died in that school. They weren't, murdered necessarily, but died from illness, died of starvation, died from trying to escape. And many of them were buried in unmarked graves in Rapid City. And what ended up happening was, this was a sort of a history and story that many people in the Rapid City area either did not know about, or that tried to sort of hide and not have people know about. And it was tied very deeply to land, and the school that where many children passed away, where many children were educated, became a sanatorium for Native Americans who were suffering from tuberculosis. And when Rapid City began to grow after World War II, there was discussions about what to do with the land where that sanatorium was and existed. And many Native Americans already lived in that area to be closer to their families, and were physically displaced from that land and moved to another part of Rapid City where there were no municipal services, no running water, no electricity, obviously, and were forced out of that area to make room for schools, for white Americans, for white Rapid City residents to have access to housing. And these stories are all tied in into the Rapid City Indian Boarding School Memorial called Remembering the Children. And what's so interesting about Remembering the Children is how different the memorial and the process were from how Rushmore was created. I mean, Rushmore was basically the vision of one man who spearheaded this, this idea through and changed and altered the face of this mountain in the Black Hills. And the Remembering the Children Memorial started as a community project where people began to learn more about this forgotten history, began to learn and talk to elders who knew about these unmarked graves and what had happened in the 1950s and 60s when people were being displaced. And so it really became not just a memorial to the kids who died, but to this other history that had been forgotten in Rapid City. And what is happening now there is a very different kind of memorialization process than you're seeing at Mount Rushmore, that incorporates the land itself in ways that aren't necessarily altering it, that incorporates community visions of art and purpose in a way that Mount Rushmore really never has. And so it's one way to sort of think a little bit about how we do memorialize our histories and what histories we do memorialize. What is a memorial? And oftentimes we think about that and we think of Mount Rushmore, of the Lincoln Memorial, these gigantic concrete blocks of granite that sort of represent these larger than life figures. But what the memorial in Rapid City is doing, what Remembering the Children is doing, is sort of coming at it from a much different direction, in a way that is, in some senses more powerful than what Mount Rushmore really is.
One of the sort of scenes, if you will, that in that connection, the woman who's now the executive director of that children's memorial made a presentation, and someone came up to her afterward and said, "Am I responsible for the sins of my father?" And her answer was, "No, but you are responsible for what's happening now and what happens in the future."
Yeah, and I think, that's one of the questions that, as Americans, we ask ourselves a lot, and especially, in these debates over, America 250 and historical narratives. I think these questions of, this happened 100 years ago. Why am I responsible for what happened 100 years ago? Well, Amy's answer, the executive director, was, you're not, but you are responsible for what's happening today. And that means not just acting on things, but learning about things, being open to these complicated narratives. And that's something, that unfortunately we're seeing in the Trump administration, a sanitization of our history at our national parks, at our national memorials, at our national museums that, you know, prevents that kind of complicated understanding that Amy was talking about when she was asked that question after she presented in Rapid City.
And in that connection, President Trump has proposed a national garden of heroes. And you wrote an op-ed piece or an editorial piece for The Hill talking about that because the governor of South Dakota suggested the vicinity of Rushmore might be a good place for it. What was your take on it? You basically argued that's not the right place.
The Black Hills are not the right place for a Garden of Heroes for a lot of reasons. But I think we as Americans made the mistake of, placing Rushmore in the Black Hills 100 years ago. We don't need to compound it by putting a National Garden of Heroes in that same space, you know, as that idea, as that project develops. And, you know, I think I just mentioned about Rushmore being a mistake. And I want to complicate that because I don't mean it to be, you know, one of the things that I hope my book gets across is that, like, I'm American and I'm, you know, sometimes proud to be an American, other times not proud to be an American. I certainly think it's well within people's rights to want to have places and locations to feel patriotic and proud of their country. I mean, that's an important part of our identity, and we as Americans should have that opportunity. But we need to think a little bit about where those places are, right? And I think, you know, certainly placing something that has become as patriotic as Mount Rushmore in an area just such with such fraught history, if not the best idea.
There's also, for some number of years, like 75 or 76 years, there's been an effort to create a Crazy Horse Memorial out not far from Mount Rushmore. You make mention of this in the book, and you also make mention of comparing that to Mount Rushmore. You're a little bit happier with the outcome for Mount Rushmore so far than you are with the Crazy Horse Memorial effort.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny you say that because I literally was just in South Dakota last week, and Crazy Horse, the past year or two, has done an excellent job of reconfiguring its leadership team. They're led for the first time by a Native American, and there's a board that is much more intentional about how money is being raised and spent. And when I wrote this book, that had really not happened. Crazy Horse is very complicated for me because I think, like many people, when I first went to the Black Hills, I was, you know, in my mind, you know, equating, you know, Rushmore problematic, Crazy Horse the right way to do things, you know, but that's, it's not that simple, and it's not the case. I mean, you know, there are a lot of reasons for it, primarily having to do with the family who ran Crazy Horse for decades, and they're a non-Native family who used the name Crazy Horse to rake in a lot of money for themselves. And, you know, the joke in the Black Hills was always, well, Crazy Horse will never get finished because if it gets finished, then the Zuchowskis won't be able to make any more money. So there's, you know, the way that memorial was constructed, how it was built, you know, was not a good alternative to how Mount Rushmore was built. And at least, you know, my argument in the book is that at least Mount Rushmore was pretty obvious about what it was doing, right? I mean, Borglum never, you know, never had any ulterior motives for this. He wanted to build the sculpture to honor the United States. I think the Crazy Horse Memorial did have ulterior motives that were not explicitly mentioned at the beginning of the process. And that always unsettled me. And I do want to emphasize that I think things are changing there. I've had people that I am close with tell me that things are changing there. So I'm hopeful that there could be a different way to go about that monument and memorial as well.
And in the book, as we sort of begin to tie all this together, you do talk about monuments and place, that a monument is inextricably tied to where it is.
It very much is. And Rushmore is definitely that way. And I think most monuments and memorials are that way. And you know, and that's what I want people to get out of reading this book is to not provide, you know, answers necessarily, but for them to think about questions. You know, next time they see a monument or a memorial in their town, or if they're walking the National Mall in D.C., or they're somewhere else and they come across a sculpture of a historical figure, you know, to ask why that memorial is in that specific place. And some make great sense to have in those locations, some maybe not so great sense. And so to think a little bit about what the purposes of those monuments and those places are.
In the intro to your book, you talk about how you had founded an International Writers Center in 2016. That's where you and I first became acquainted, was leading to the founding of that International Center. We're talking about the Alan Chuse International Writers Center at George Mason University, which you had a concept, I had a concept, we matched our concepts. I went away from George Mason in 2018, and you were left to make that thing happen, which those of us who are back again associated with the Chuse Center owe you a great deal of gratitude and a great deal of thanks for having launched it and made things happen. So thank you for that. You also talk about in the intro about how you've kind of pivoted from that point where you were thinking more internationally and thinking about international writers to thinking a little bit differently. And this ties to the idea of the individual and place, I think, right?
Well, I mean, it has to do in part with having two young sons. I have two boys who the oldest is about to turn 8 and the youngest is 5. And I think, you know, when I was not married and had kids, I spent a lot of time overseas. I lived overseas. I traveled overseas. I wrote about overseas issues. And place was always important when I was doing that. But I think what changed a little bit is, you know, in the tumult of 2020 was trying to wrestle with what it means and meant and still to this day to be an American, to wonder what country I'm raising my kids in. And so that's, I think, where the pivot began. And I've, you know, one of the things that always interested me about Rushmore from the start was the way that encapsulated so many of our national myths, our relationships to Native communities, our westward expansion, you know, our search for gold, the idea that, you know, we can do big things. What are sort of the key words that define us as a country? Liberty, freedom, these terms that sort of are very closely tied to Mount Rushmore. And so, you know, for me, Rushmore became a way to honestly learn about American history. When I had for so long been working with international writers or being overseas or writing about overseas issues. So I've always been interested in place, but this is a way for me to become more interested in the place, in the country that I was born and where my kids are growing up, at least for now.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. This has been a real pleasure talking about catching up with you. And I learned a lot reading this book. Rushmore, to me, is that open sky, the image that we get in the photographs, and to actually sort of, you know, get a sense of it. And I think this is one of those sort of what I call an unimportant but interesting fact. There's a little bit of unevenness. There's some imperfections. As one of the historians and one of the artists that you talk to talks about, people making it learned as they went along. The first portraits are a little less perfect than the later ones. Washington's eyes aren't exactly even, for example.
Yeah, I mean, it was, again, that kind of process probably would not be the case today, where they'd have a lot more 3D imaging of things and know exactly, you know, where to put things and how much rock would need to be blown off and where not to blow off rock and all this stuff.
And they'd probably do it with lasers instead of pneumatic drills or something.
They would do it very different. And Fat Crazy Horse, which is still going on, they're doing their stone removal, shall we say, in much more modern ways. But I think one of the reasons why I wanted to approach this subject, and one of the reasons why the cover of the book, for example, is not just the sculpture but the mountain, is because I really do and did intend this to be more of a story of that mountain and the Black Hills and not just the sculpture itself.
Since you bring up the book, I hope listeners will go buy it, but the picture is black and white.
The picture's black and white on the cover, yeah. And what you don't get in the advanced reader copy that you got, Bill, but the finished product, the hardcover, will include about 25 amazing photographs. About maybe half, a little bit more than half, were taken by a very close friend of mine. He's a wonderful photographer. And they're contemporary photos of people and places affiliated with the book, but also another dozen or so historical photos of Mount Rushmore as it began to grow, as it began to be built, as that area began to transform from what it was in 1925 to what it became in 1941.
Now I got to go buy the book. I can't just content myself with the art.
You got to buy the book.
Everybody got to buy the book for the photos as well as the prose.
Yeah, they work hand in hand.
Does the use of a black and white photo mean anything? I mean, maybe it doesn't. Maybe you didn't have a color one of, with exactly that image. But what strikes me is the truth in black and white is what came to mind when I looked at that cover.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, that was not the intention. I think it's the I mean, first of all, I don't think this book is a black and white book in terms of truth. At least I hope it doesn't read that way to people, because I want there to be a lot of nuance and complexity.
But that's what I mean. That is the truth. You know, there's the perception and there's the deeper truth, and which is ironic. And that's what I mean about the book's delivering on the promise of the cover, if you will.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, I mean, I think quite honestly, the image was one that encapsulated the vision of what we wanted to do with the book, which is to decentralize the sculpture and emphasize the mountain itself.
Well done.
Thank you.
And again, thank you for your time today. I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been great to be on, Bill. It's good to see you again.
Thank you for listening to Upstart Crow. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Your feedback helps others find the show. Be sure to follow us on social media and check out our website at upstartcrow.org for more information on our episodes, guests, and ways you can support the podcast. You'll find all of the links in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time right here on Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio.